All right. Hi, everybody. So it's my pleasure to introduce our speaker today. This is Dr. Anthony Cerulli. He's assistant professor of religious and Asian studies at Hobart and William and Smith College. He was here a couple years ago and gave a series of three lectures, and he's going to be doing that same thing this year. So today he's going to give a lecture on the Four Noble Truths in context. It's the history and representation of the Four Noble Truths in early Buddhism. And then coming up on April 6th, he's going to give one called Buddhist Teaching, Buddhist Experience. This is what the Buddha taught as a network of teachings meant for the cultivation of religious experience among Buddhist practitioners. And then the last one he'll give on May 4th, and this is called Buddhism After the Buddha, the Cultures of Buddhism in Asia Elsewhere. And this is the way that some of the places that Buddhism spread to after the Buddha. And he's going to highlight some of the ways that Buddhist ideas and practices were modified to fit and incorporate into new cultures. So all these are going to take place after brunch right here. It's around 11 o'clock. And he's also asking if you guys have any questions throughout to just go ahead and raise your hand, and he'll field any questions when the time comes. So here we are.
Thanks. Okay. Yeah, absolutely. There are slides, obviously, and try to keep the text to a minimum so that there's not a lot for you to read. There will be a couple slides with things to read. How do we explain that on the audio?
Sorry, Anthony.
We should project it onto the alternate.
How did this go up the
road? Oh, there we go. Did you say that? The problem is the thing that holds that.
So if a slide goes too quickly and you didn't get to see what was on there and you'd like to see it again, I'm happy to stop and we can go back and whatever. Don't be shy in that regard. Just let me know. And if you have a question as well in the course of what I'm saying, that's fine too. We can address those questions then. And then certainly when it's all over, there are plenty opportunities there for questions as well. So the title of the talk, The Four Noble Truths in Context, is a big topic, right? And so it's something we could talk about through the course of all three of the upcoming talks, but we'll try and keep it condensed today. So I'm very happy to be back. Thanks to Kathy, who is the person I've been speaking with mostly on the steering committee, and Andy was there, and Joanna, whom I don't see here, and Deborah for inviting me back. It's really nice to be back again. I enjoyed the last visit here 2 years ago, and I learned a lot in the course of those talks myself and conversation with everybody here, and it's very nice to be here. I look forward to talking to you all again. And with that, let me get started. So that worked. And unfortunately, that's not entirely clear, but what we have here is where I want to start is a map that you're going to be seeing a couple times throughout the course of this talk. We'll be talking about what happened in the course of the Buddha's life, and his later life in particular, and where this happens is what I'll be referring to as South Asia. I'm going to test out both sides as I talk and see what's more convenient. Is South Asia, and it's a we apply the label of South to Asia in this case, and what that refers to usually when you say South Asia is the biggest country in that region is India, but it also includes Sri Lanka, Bangladesh, Bhutan, Nepal, Pakistan, and you should usually include Afghanistan in that conversation too. Some people do, some people don't. But if we're talking about the life of the Buddha, this really focuses on a really small sort of area within the South Asian region. And that's right here, which is on the border of contemporary Nepal and northeastern India, right basically in what's called the Gangetic Plain, or the plain where the Ganges River is. And that's this map over here. So here's the Ganges River. It runs down into what's perhaps the most important holy city in the religion of Hinduism, called Varanasi, also known as Benares. Maybe some of you have been to India, and maybe you've been to this city. It's a very interesting city. The Buddha spent his life right around here. Okay, and we could talk about the biography of the Buddha, and that could take the whole talk today, but we need to sort of move forward in order to get to where the Four Noble Truths came out, so we can understand in which context he said them. So, just quickly, he was born here in Lumbini. This is the grove or the garden where his mother Maya gave birth to him. His father was the king of Kapilavastu, which is right here, and this is basically where he grew up. And then I'm going to fast forward to age 29. Can you guys read the text that's up here? Some of that font looks small to me now that I see it. So we go to age 29. Up until age 29, he lived in Kapilavastu with his father. He was a prince. He was had a very luxurious life. He apparently had three palaces that his father gave him for the three seasons that you have in northern India, northeastern India up here. But for a variety of reasons, he wasn't happy with that life. You've perhaps heard some of the stories of the Buddha and the experiences that he had that led him to ultimately leave Kapilavastu. And that happened at age 29. And he leaves, and he sets out on really the beginning of this great adventure that he has, looking for awakening, looking for what is often called enlightenment, a kind of understanding of the truth of the nature of reality. What are you seeing, and what is it, and how do I really understand my purpose here on the planet? This lasts for about 6 years, so until he's 35. In the course of those 6 years, he meets up with a lot of different people. This part of South Asia, the northern part of India at the time, was very rich with diverse traditions, religious, philosophical, sociological traditions, in which people were debating about various ways in which to understand the human condition and the role of humanity within the world in which we live. Hinduism would have been, at this time, or what becomes Hinduism, the sort of precursor to Hinduism, the predominant sort of ideology, religious or philosophical system. But there were others too, many others. And he went out, Gautama went out, and he talked to a lot of these peoples, and he dabbled in various sorts of practices that were associated with these traditions. I think this was one of the talks that I gave a couple years ago, was this sort of interaction of these different schools and these different thinkers. And what happens is he meets up with a bunch of, sort of gurus who help him learn about yoga and meditation, and he surpasses a lot of his teachers. He's very skilled in everything that he does his entire life, and he ultimately hooks up with a band of five ascetics, five companions, who are committed really to this process of heightening and cultivating knowledge through the abnegation or the denial of the body. So he gets to a point in his life where he's practicing what we call severe religious austerities, meditating, fasting in particular, with these five companions, where he's almost at the point of death. He's some of the biographies say that he's at this point where you could see his ribcage through the front of his stomach. He was that emaciated. And he was living off of one drop of water and one grain of rice a day. And he was at the point of death, and they had this experience where he really thought maybe he was about to die, and he had made all of these great intellectual, psychological advancements, and then, what happens if you die at that point? Are the advancements for naught? Where do they lead? Is it okay to die in this case? There were traditions that were competing with Gautama and with other traditions like Hinduism at the time that said, yeah, dying as a result of fasting is actually quite a spiritually beneficial and worthy sort of thing. But he wasn't of that mind at the end, and he's approached by a young woman who sees him at the point of almost death, and she offers him a bowl of some sort of yogurt rice mix, and he takes it. And he realizes that fasting to the point of death or possibly dying before he's reached what he realizes is awakening or enlightenment is not the way to go. But when his five companions see that he has taken the food, right, that he hasn't gone all the way to possibly dying as a result of denying the body, they reject him. And they say, you've given up on the path that we, found to be the most rigorous and the most important.
and they leave him alone. They sort of ridicule him, and they go off. And this is sort of where the seed for what is called the middle way is planted for Gautama, which will later be called the middle way. He realizes that it's not denial of the body that's going to lead to ultimate awakening, and conversely, there are other people who profess that excess or indulgence was the way to awakening as well. And he thought that those folks didn't have the right idea either, but there must be something in between, and this is what ultimately becomes the middle way. So he shares a lot of practice with these people, these five companions in particular, but then they have this split, this break, and they part ways. Shortly after that parting, after that break, Gautama leaves and goes to the village of Bodh Gaya, and it's here where you've perhaps heard of him sitting underneath the Bodhi tree, right? And this is Bodh Gaya right here, and this is what's called the Bodhi tree. It's not the Bodhi tree that Gautama actually sat under. However, it's supposed to have been an offshoot, of the original plant that has been cultivated and replanted and so on. I don't know the details, the botanical details of this, but there's a little shrine underneath the tree here, recognizing where Gautama ultimately had his awakening. And the word Bodhi itself just means awakening, or often people will translate it as enlightenment. It's actually a ficus religiosus, if somebody is better Latin than I am, and maybe you know what that plant is. That's what the tree is itself. So he goes to Bodh Gaya. He's determined at this point to, you know, take the last sort of step in his process leading towards Bodhi or awakening. And he goes through a night-long meditation. And at the result of this night-long meditation, when he wakes up after a bunch of different stages of heightening awareness and grappling with this demon called Mara, who tries to break him out of his meditation through temptations and so on and so forth, he awakens Buddha, awakened, which is what the word Buddha means. And then when you make it into a capital B as a proper name, he is the Buddha at this point. He's the Buddha Gautama. And this all happens in Bodh Gaya. Now, post-awakening, some of the biographies differ here. They say that he sat there for about a week. Others say that he sat there for several weeks, just enjoying this new state of awakening that he has, just sitting there. And he's approached while he's sitting there around the Bodhi tree by a couple different people. A couple merchants come to him, and they see him, and they say, "Look at this guy, he's sitting down here. He looks like he's, you know, learned something very important. He's smiling, or he seems very serene, almost glowing." And they say, "Hey, excuse us. Can you tell us what you're doing? You know, what do you know? What is going on? We're very curious as to why you look the way you look, because you look very special." And he says, "I do know something, but I don't think I'm ready, or I don't think you're ready to receive what it is that I know." And so he rejects their sort of invitation to become their teacher. And he didn't think that they were ready for it. And ultimately, as the stories go, it's a god, Brahma, it's an important Hindu deity, who encourages him to teach what he learned in that night-long meditation, everything that led up to that point. And this is where the content of the Four Noble Truths comes from. It came from, ultimately, the sort of crystallization of these four truths that we'll talk about in just a moment, came during that night-long meditation that he first thought people were not ready to receive, in the story of those two merchants who approached him. It's too weighty for people. I just don't think, most folks are ready for it. And then at the encouragement of a deity, of a god, who also wanted to know what the Buddha knew, interestingly enough, he decides, fine, it's time, I can do this. And so he goes from Bodh Gaya, which you see over here, I think maybe I've got even some animation there. Yep. That's a first for me.
I didn't see it.
It goes.
What is it? I didn't see.
Oh yeah, we can go back. I think. So go from Bodh Gaya. It's about 250 kilometers, if we need to measure.
Oh, gotcha.
To Sarnath. So Sarnath is just at the edge of Varanasi. It's been a bike ride, so I've biked back and forth from Sarnath to Varanasi before. Again, right in the Gangetic Plain, or in the plain of the Ganges there. And he goes there, whether it's a week or a few weeks after the actual night of enlightenment in Bodh Gaya is up for grabs, according to the different biographies that you read of the Buddha. And this is where everything really begins. This is after his enlightenment. It happens in the town of Sarnath. So in the town of Sarnath, when he goes there, we refer to this as a couple different things. His first post-enlightenment lecture, you might say. It's the way it's often called. But tradition recognizes it as the first turning of the wheel of Dharma when he goes to Sarnath and he gives his first explication of the things that he had learned. This is what we call the first turning of the wheel of Dharma. There will be subsequent turnings of the wheel of Dharma as well. This is a very sort of common picture. I know that you'll probably all know what this is because I've seen it around the Zendo here. This is, of course, the Dharma Chakra, the wheel of Dharma. But maybe you know, or maybe you don't, why there are deer on either side. This is very common in Tibetan iconography. So if you've seen a Tibetan temple and you see the wheel of Dharma, the Dharma Chakra, you might have seen deer on either side too. Does anybody know why?
He's in the deer park, right? Mm-hmm.
Exactly. So when he goes to Sarnath, this town next to Varanasi, he goes to a park within Sarnath. It's called Deer Park, where there apparently were lots of deer. They symbolize the location where the first turning of the wheel of Dharma took place. So what he does when he gets there is he's ready to share what he knows. And to whom is he going to share what he knows? He has an audience of five. These five right here. Kondana, Vapa, Badiya, Mahanama, and Asaji. Any guesses as to who these five were?
The ascetics.
They were the five ascetics that broke with him earlier on, exactly, who now become the first sort of witnesses and early disciples of Gautama and the teachings that he gives. Now, it's important, I think, to show here that it's a kata for an audience of five. This is a Sanskrit word, and really what that means is it's a conversation. If you read literature translations in English, you probably, or maybe you've seen it as a sermon, and I've already said lecture, but it really wasn't quite like that. Certainly not a sermon because of sort of baggage that we often associate with that in the Christian sort of context. It wasn't like that. It was a conversation, really, of him just sort of explaining what he knew and what he experienced on that night-long meditation. And it's in this it's in this text where we get the story of this. It's called the Dharma Chakra, Pravartana Sutra. So the sutra or the text on the turning of the wheel of Dharma is where we get this first sort of story. And he says about four things to these five people. And break it down into four quarters, essentially. And he said, really, the first thing that I want to tell you, that I know, that I've learned, is that you should avoid extremes. You should avoid devotion to sensual pleasures as well as devotion to mortification of the body. This is what he learned after those 6 years of talking to people across northeastern India about whether you should be indulging in things or denying things from yourself. And he said, neither one of those is the way to go if you want to attain awakening like he has now attained. The second thing is, he said, well, what's in between? You know, so I'm telling you not to go this way, I'm telling you not to go this way, but there must be something in between. And this is where we get the sort of origination of what's called the middle way between these two extremes. And here we also get a reference to the Noble Eightfold Path. That's what goes in between those two extremes. Following this Eightfold Path, which becomes also integrated into the Four Noble Truths, as we'll see, this is the second content of what he said. And then he says, well, where does it go? Right? So I'm telling you not to do this or not to do that, but to go here. You might want to know where I'm suggesting you go. And it goes to things like insight, knowledge, calm, and ultimately awakening, which is the grand goal for him at this point, which he had just recently attained. And then the fourth part is where it leads us to the topic of today's conversations. He gave these four profound insights, we refer to as the Four Noble Truths. Now there's a common misnomer about this title, right? The Four Noble Truths, it's not the truths that are noble when the Buddha gave this lesson. It's not that these truths are any more noble or more worthy than another truth, right? If we can identify a series of truths, these truths are as important as any other truth, but rather, it's the four truths for nobles is what the Buddha was offering in this case. And this is important socio-historically insofar as the words here, this is the Sanskrit down here. Chatvari means four. Arya is the word for noble in this case, and satyani is the truths. Arya is a word that, what in Hinduism, it's very important. It does mean noble, noble ones. The Buddha's using this as a way to speak against some of the most important aspects of the social hierarchy within Hinduism. People who are noble within the early Hindu community belong to an upper echelon of a social structure which allowed them access to religious practice, access to education, and things that the Buddha thought was not an appropriate way to construct a society. It's not about where you're born. If you're born into a noble class, that should allow you to have things, as the Hindu community was professing at the time. But it's about the merit, the merit of your deeds, the things that you do, the things that you say, that should give you, you know, any sort of thing that you achieve in life. It's whether you're from a low class or a high class, that's where you should be able to recognize a person as being worthy or as having any sort of access to things that matter in society. And so in this case, the Buddha is saying that these four truths are for noble people. And in this case, noble means anybody who is open to and willing to receive the things that he's about to teach or the things that he's teaching. People who are receptive to it and can not only just intellectually agree with the things that he's saying, but implement them and put them into practice and cultivate them within their lives. So it's not about birth, in other words, which becomes the Hindu sort of idea of social structure. You're born into a noble class. But it's about what you're willing to do and then how you're going to implement those sorts of things into your life. So now the four truths. These are, I suspect, things that you're all familiar with. The first one is the truth of suffering. And in parentheses, you get the Sanskrit word, dukkha. And here's where we get a little bit of text. So it wants you to know from that text, the sutra on the turning of the wheel of Dharma, this is where we find a comment like this. So this, O monks, and of course, each one of these is going to be including this reference to O monks. He's speaking to the five monks, is the truth of suffering. Birth is suffering. Sickness is suffering, death is suffering, to be united with the unloved is suffering, to be separated from the loved is suffering, not to obtain what one desires is suffering, to obtain what one does not desire is suffering. And in short, clinging to earthly things is suffering. Attachment, in this case, clinging, leads to suffering. Often we can simply just say, we can sum all of this up, and many people do when they write this, is that life is suffering in this case. At the end of the day, life is saddled. The person is saddled with suffering, and these are some of the reasons as to why we're suffering. Yes?
I was just going to quickly ask, I've heard a lot of different definitions for the word, or translations to the word dukkha. And I wanted to ask you if you thought suffering was the best, or what word you would choose, or...
Yeah, it's a good question. I would use dukkha, right? which is not a great answer for what you're asking. The other translation that I use is it's really clumsy, but it's dissatisfactory or dissatisfactoriness or unsatisfactory and unsatisfactoriness. These things lead to a sense of being dissatisfied in that way. The problem of translation is a perennial one, but those two things. Suffering, I think, is the most readily identifiable translation. So that's what I tend to use. You could say pain, too, perhaps, but dissatisfactory or unsatisfactory, and then adding the nest to it as well would be another way, I think, that could possibly be helpful.
Yeah. It's also vexation.
Vexation.
See, the Chinese use that. Of course, I don't know why they would use an English word, but the Shen stuff that's translated, you see vexation used a lot.
Yeah,
it's a good word.
That is nice. It gets to the sort of the dissatisfactory
right.
sort of notion as well. Yeah. I think suffering's the most common, perhaps, but there are probably nuances that we could add to it that could be helpful too, such as vexation and dissatisfactory. You'll find a variety of things. You know, I could get really pedantic, you know, and continue with what I said, is that at the end of the day, translation gets in the way. I probably shouldn't go down that road, and otherwise we'll never get through the rest, but it's a great question. It really is a good question. So then there's the origin of suffering. Samudaya, again the Sanskrit word here. This, O monks, is the truth of the origin of suffering. It is thirst that leads to rebirth, thirst for sensual pleasures, thirst for being, thirst for non-existence. Now, thirst is the very literal translation of what the Buddha said here, tirshna, or tanha, in the Pali, tirshna in the Sanskrit. Here you'll see desire used in this case often as the translation, but he really did say thirst in this way. The word that you would use if you were composing in Sanskrit or in Pali, if you wanted to say, I have great thirst, this is the same word that, because you want water or coffee or something, you would have used the same word. And there are possible explanations for this. This is something that people understand, right? You know what it means to actually be craving for something at a very visceral and physical level. And then you can unpack that or expand it into a more conceptual, perhaps, way later as you get into more conversations. But he used the word thirst in this case. That's what leads to dukkha. So he identified the problem. Now he's telling you what the cause is. The third... Yes, yeah?
So the last was... thirst for non-existence.
Yes.
Can you talk a little bit more about that?
Sure. This is related to, directly related to those 6 years, right? So where he's talking about, so there's thirst for being, you could say existence in that case, and then there's also a thirst for non-existence. Being too attached to trying to attain enlightenment in this way can also be an impediment to enlightenment in a sort of paradoxical sort of way there. This is a question that, you know, I think a lot of people ask and should ask, right? What does that mean? You know, is that not itself a thirst to try and attain Bodhi that the Buddha was after? But if you're too concentrated, and we'll come back to this also, if you're too focused on the grand goal as opposed to the path that's leading to it, it can get in the way of your practice leading towards what it is that you're after. In the same way, for being, this is for celebrity perhaps, or for being something, you know, outstanding in a way that becomes a grander goal than what the Buddha is trying to teach you, which is practice, and practice for certain sorts of, with good intent, with certain sort of motivations, and so on. Is that helpful? Yeah? The third, cessation of suffering, Nirodha. This, among us, is the truth of the cessation of suffering, the complete annihilation of thirst. Letting it go, expelling it, separating oneself from it, giving it no room, leads to the cessation of suffering. So you identify a problem, talk about the origin or the cause of that problem, and now he's talking about a kind of upshot to this. There is an upshot to it. You can get rid of it. That you need to stop the thirst to get over the suffering. The first two often are considered, or people see them, as a very sort of pessimistic view, and it's here. The third one, where you can kind of have a little bit of hope in this case, is that it's not always going to be full of pain, suffering, vexation, dissatisfactoriness. But you need to do something about it. You need to nip it in the bud. You need to get rid of the thirst. You need to stop it where the problem's being caused. And so... it's here in the third truth where he gives a possible uplifting prognosis. There may be something positive throughout all of this. Now, what's the upshot of the cessation of suffering? Here within, embedded within, and then elaborated by traditions over the centuries, we see a very important concept within Buddhism defined and debated and discussed. It comes out of the third one here. So what is the upshot? What does the cessation of suffering then open oneself up to? Maybe the grand goal of Buddhism, if we had to say what the grand goal of Buddhism was.
Happiness.
No. Happiness is a great grand goal. And I just brought some students to the Tibetan monastery in Ithaca this week, and we talked about happiness over and over and over with the Lama who was there. And... the way he was talking about it, in fact, looks like what I'm about to show you right here. And it's a good conversation to talk about a possible synonym. What I'm about to show you. Nirvana, yeah, is where this gets elaborated. The upshot of the end of suffering is it leads to awakening, which results in the realization and experience of this. So there are two shades to nirvana. There's nirvana and there's parinirvana. After the Buddha became Bodhi, after he attained Bodhi and became Buddha, he attained awakening and became the Buddha, he experienced, lived in a state of nirvana.
But his body doesn't stop working. You know, you're released from the cycle of rebirth after you attain that state, but you don't just drop dead at the moment of awakening after the first experience of nirvana. But he lived for 45 years after that awakening, fully experiencing nirvana. And then at the end of the body, when he turned 80 years old, he takes what's called parinirvana, or the final nirvana. Then the body is no longer working. There's no more rebirth into the cycle of rebirth and redeath and so on. And what nirvana means in this case, very literally in the Sanskrit word, simply means blowing out. It's just really, that's what the word means, just blowing out. And then it picks up, in the Buddhist context, these sorts of conceptual meanings to help explain the teachings of the Buddha. It's a blowing out of what? Of the flame of thirst. That's the cessation of suffering in that case. You blow out this drive for things that are getting, you know, in the way, the flame of thirst, or you'll also see it as extinction or extinguishing of the three poisons. And the three poisons that the Buddha often taught were greed, hatred, and delusion, or raga, dvesha, and moha. That's what you're blowing out. And it really, blowing out in this case, I think, is an apt term if you think about what the cycle of rebirth and redeath is, right? You can think of it in terms of a candle, and you think of it in terms of the candles that I've always known as trick candles that light up again after you blow them out. But the final blowing out, right, is when this parinirvana is, you blow it out, it doesn't light up again, and you're not reborn back into this cycle of suffering. Just curious, what do you think? Do you think the Buddha frequently addressed the question, what is nirvana? He was asked a lot. So he taught for 45 years after he attained awakening, and people often said, his disciples and people who were not his disciples, said, so, Gautama, what's this nirvana, right, that we've heard about? Do you think this is something that he would say, well, here's what it is?
It's going to be this grunge band in the 80s.
Yeah, he probably knew. Yeah.
John? He would only talk about things that would help him following the path and speculating. And also he said that nirvana could not be described adequately, so there was just no point.
Yep. He was very, very reluctant to address it. Whenever you see people approach him and offer this sort of question, what is it? He would redirect their questions to, you know, why do you want to know? Are you asking me things that are going to be helpful to you in your path towards awakening? And basically redirecting them into a process of questioning, of inquiry, that he thought would be helpful, and modeling for them inquiry that would be helpful for them in the path to what the state is. And of course, like many things within Hinduism, Buddhism, Jainism, these traditions, trying to describe the grand sort of goal or the nature of reality after you've attained something like awakening often is not really possible at the end of the day, as you just said, with language in a way. It's an experience. It's something that you realize rather than be able to articulate with language. So the fourth, so that whole little nirvana slide back there is what's elaborated within the third of the four truths. The fourth is now the treatment, right? And if we use sort of medical terms, and a lot of people do see these Four Noble Truths as a sort of medical approach to the human condition. The fourth is the treatment, the prescription. It's the path, the marga, leading to the end of suffering. And he said, here, this, O monks, this is the truth of the path leading to the end of suffering. It's the Eightfold Path. And so now we get a little bit of detail into the Eightfold Path. And I'll just put them up here. Perhaps seen these before. There are eight things here. They're all prefaced with right in the sense of proper understanding, aspiration, speech, action, livelihood, effort, mindfulness, and concentration. I had intended to speak on these in particular with the exception of this. Right action has within it the 10 precepts, which I suspect you've perhaps also heard of as well, which is a kind of list of things within action that you've phrased in a way of abstaining from certain things. Historically, particularly within Theravada Buddhist communities, the first five are for the entire Sangha, the lay and the monastic component of the Sangha, and then all 10 are what the nuns and the monks would
take on them for themselves. So abstaining from harming living beings, taking things that are not given, abstaining from sexual misconduct, false speech, intoxicants, and then for the monks and nuns, abstaining from taking solid food after midday, frivolous entertainment, unnecessary ornamentation, sleeping on raised cushy beds, and involvement with currency. I can pause here if anybody wants to ask any questions. For me, there are questions when I look at this list, particularly when you get past number five.
We take 10 precepts here, and the second five are not those. So
yeah,
I don't know.
Yeah, it's
where
the Mahayana precepts. So yeah, yeah, speaking of the deeds of others, and
okay,
praising oneself and reviling others, and refraining from anger and not reviling the three treasures. There's another one there, but I skipped.
Uh huh. Yeah.
That's right.
Yeah,
oh, not
spiritually,
spiritually, withholding spiritual and material aid is the, yeah, it's the other one.
This almost feels like instructions for a monk or something.
And five,
the five, second five.
Yeah.
These all 10 are for monks and nuns, but then just the top five are what the lay community. So this is why in the Theravada community, which is going to adhere as closely to what we see in the teachings of the Buddha, which is going to you'll see in the next slide. It's called the Pali Canon. The Tripitaka, it becomes critical. So if you go to Myanmar, for example, these would be the 10 precepts you would see in a Theravada Buddhist community. But often when I show these to students, there are people raising questions about number 6, and you know, I think that's perhaps the one that has been, to my mind, least satisfactory. The explanations have been least satisfactory, and there's not a really good explanation. The Buddha famously said that I don't take food after noon, and I'm perfectly healthy. And so that's kind of, you know, explanation. It's not really a satisfactory one to my mind, but there are other people who have explained it according to the interruption of digestion in one's meditation, which goes on throughout the day, and so on. So there are other possible explanations, but I like what the Buddha said himself.
Yeah, it's interesting that he said in terms of that I'm healthy, because food is taken after midday in Tibet and in China and in northern countries, but it's termed medicine. So the evening meal is the medicine meal, and so I think it's because of the climate you really can't do as well.
Yep.
Possibly, you know, not eating before, not eating after midday, and so they do, and they frame it that way.
Yeah, and culturally things like, and certainly the difference in Theravada and Mahayana are going to make a difference, but culturally, in terms of where Buddhism finds a home and is in place, diet and things like this, and medicine and diet, which are intimately related in a place like Tibet in particular, but also China, India as well, are going to have a huge factor on the way in which Buddhism is adapted to those locations. Yeah.
It also says solid food, so that doesn't say no food.
Yeah, it is solid food, meaning
so
like right out of the bowl.
Kind of still a kind of open thing.
You have a protein shake.
Well, this is somebody actually asked me that one. So, what do they put everything in a blender?
I'm thinking like gruel and things. I can imagine having a bowl of gruel or something in the evening.
Yeah, yeah, right. Certainly, maybe there's some room there.
Yeah, it's
for
not saying don't eat a thing after lunchtime.
Anthony, is unnecessary orientation associated with robes, or was that
ornament?
With ornament preceded
perfumes and jewelry, this sort of making, you know, it's a representation of oneself as being attached to oneself as an individual self in a way that is staunchly denied in the Buddhist teaching. Trying to, you know, where the ego comes out in that way, through one's ornamentation of oneself and trying to sort of show one's being to be prominent in a way that is unhelpful to understanding the fact that we have no self in that way. So ornamentation, clothing, jewelry, perfumes are the things that are usually described in the texts.
When did robes enter the scene, or was that prior to the Buddha? Were Hindu practitioners wearing robes?
Well, the robes don't count in this way as ornamentation. In fact, when Gautama left his home, if I'm understanding your question correctly, when he left his home, he took off the princely clothes that he had after he
he left Kapilavastu, he took them off, and he exchanged them with somebody for some, you know, some Spartan kind of robes. And so the robes themselves are not in this way considered to be overly ostentatious in terms of ornamentation. So the monks and nuns would have been dressed in a sort of uniform sort of way. This is my just reminder page that these four truths are not simply just a list of things to which we all nod and say, yeah, right, life's suffering, thirst causes suffering, desire leads to suffering, and there's a possible way to end it. Great, yes, that's fine, and there's a way to do it in the Eightfold Path. But the Buddha was very adamant about making sure that the people who listened to him understood that this is a method. This is something that needs to be implemented in one's life, something that needs to be practiced and cultivated. And it may not just be this life in which, you know, you're able to cultivate these things, but countless lifetimes. So what's the relationship between doctrine and religious experience? What the Buddha called his teaching, so at that first turning of the wheel of Dharma in Saranat, and then in subsequent ones, what he referred to as his teaching was the Dharma Vinaya. So Dharma means the teaching, and Vinaya is the conduct. So often doctrine and conduct are these things right here, doctrine and religious experience. That's what he was teaching. And what's the relationship between these things? That's actually more or less the content of the second talk, as Andy explained, that we'll talk about next month. But there's something I think that's interesting to think about in this regard now, it's worth saying, is that tradition recognizes that Gautama had a three-step relationship to each one of the four noble truths. Each one of the four truths, they say, that he first saw the first truth, then the second truth, the fourth truth, and so on, and he understood what was there, and then he developed the truth of suffering, the truth of the origin of suffering, the truth of the cessation of suffering, and the truth of the path to the cessation of suffering. He practiced it. He put it into practice. And then third, he realized it. So these three stages. And then at the state of realization of what each one of these things means, tradition says, the early tradition says that he no longer at that point had anything to learn from them. But he certainly could teach them, and that's what he did. He talked to people about what he understood and what he learned and was able to practice. And then this little thing over here is simply what I just said, is that this is the relationship that will go into the talk in April, is what's the relationship between what the texts say the early followers of the Buddha needed to do in order to implement, in order to make ideas practical in their lives. It's a difficult thing, I think, to bridge sometimes. And I mentioned that I had students at a Tibetan monastery just this past week, and we talked about happiness a lot, and the conversation kept coming back to, you know, what does it mean to, you know, experience happiness, and how do we know if we're happy when we're experiencing things, and you know, making these things part of one's activity and one's day-to-day life is where that next talk will go. So this relationship. Now, after Gautama dies, he's 80 years old. A lot happened in between the ages 29 or 35 when he was awakened, and then 80 when he dies and takes his parinirvana. But after he dies, we see a very important stage in the Four Noble Truths that we just talked about. There's a big effort within his group of disciples, within the Sangha that he had put in place over those 45 years of his teaching, to standardize the Dharma Vinaya, the doctrine and the discipline, or the teachings and the code of conduct for the Sangha, to make them, you know, in a way that if anybody wants to come and learn about what the Buddha taught and what he did, there could be a common experience of what they're engaged with. And so this happens through the course of Buddhist councils, what were called Buddhist councils. And the first one is the one that I'll briefly talk about today, the first Buddhist council. There would be subsequent ones. There will be four. Three, most all traditions agree upon when they were and who convened them and where they were and all of that. The fourth one has some bifurcation. The fourth one is usually split between Sri Lanka and Kashmir. By the time of the fourth one, the Buddhist schools have already become very diverse, and so there's a lots of disagreement about things by that point. But in the first Buddhist council, this happens in the town of Rajagriha over here, not far from Bodh Gaya, where he experienced his awakening. And it happened circa the 5th century BCE. This is important. There's a lot of disagreement about when the Buddha actually lived and died. There's usually about 100 years of disagreement for scholars as to when it happened. Generally speaking, 5th century BCE is a pretty conservative and fine, I think, time frame when we speak about this. So this happened in the year of the Buddha's death, and that's important. There was an obvious effort on part of the monks and nuns who were part of the early Sangha to try and get his teachings consolidated and standardized in a way while people who were actually with him were still around, right? And so that there wouldn't be a huge gap in between the time in which there was a sort of collecting of the things that he said and did and trying to get it together. And this happened here. It's what's called the First Buddhist Council. What's gathered at this First Buddhist Council is called the Tripitaka. And this is just, again, a Sanskrit word. Tri meaning three and pitaka meaning basket. It's also called the Pali Canon. And I'll explain why it's called the Pali Canon in a second, which you may already know. And what we see are these three baskets. Sutra Pitaka, Vinaya Pitaka, and Abhidharma Pitaka. The Sutra Pitaka is just the sayings of the Buddha. The Vinaya Pitaka are the rules of conduct. We've seen this now in the Dharma Vinaya. It's the code of conduct. And the Abhidharma Pitaka is the more complicated basket of the three, insofar as it's long, elaborate philosophical and psychological explanations, primarily of this basket right here. This is pretty amorphous at this council. It becomes elaborated over time, over the next 4 centuries, essentially, and gets pretty expansive. And certain schools really take to this basket more than the others in a lot of ways, where philosophy becomes a sort of centerpiece for the Buddhist tradition. Tradition says that at this first council, one of the Buddha's disciples remembered everything the Buddha ever said. They called upon him to recite everything the Buddha ever said in any of his sort of public and even some private conversations, lectures, was Ananda. He remembered all of these things. Another disciple named Upali is supposed to have remembered everything the Buddha ever did. And he's the one who told everybody at this council, roughly with about 500 monks and nuns, everything that he ever did. And so when you read these three baskets, they almost always begin with evam me sutam, thus I have heard. The Buddha said this. The Buddha did this. Thus I have heard, and so on and so forth. That's how they're almost always preface. So what's Pali? You all know what Pali is? Maybe
it's called language, right?
It's one of the classical languages of India. It's the language that's used in this way to consolidate and standardize the teachings, the early teachings, into Buddhist, what becomes early Buddhist literature. Sanskrit was also used at some times, but less so. They're related, Sanskrit and Pali, in a lot of ways. And if we were to put up the Sanskrit word next to the Pali word, you'd see there's a clear relationship between the two. And there's plenty of Buddhist Sanskrit texts. The Buddha might have used Pali. No, we don't really know. Chances are good, just like with Latin in Europe and Sanskrit for other traditions. So it was a language. Pali was a language that was used for formal sorts of purposes, for ritual purposes, for the consolidation of things into a canon, like what we're talking about here, rather than a vernacular, you know, to come out and talk with people or to share someone's knowledge with another person or to go to the store or whatever. So he most certainly spoke a vernacular language, just an everyday language. And he was from a region, there was a map behind you, I don't know if it got faded out or not, but he was a region from north eastern India, the map we saw right away at the beginning, that's called Magadha, and so the language of the people there was called Magadhi, and that was probably the language that the Buddha used most frequently when he was talking, sharing his knowledge with people. Mid-3rd century BCE, the Tripitaka goes to Sri Lanka. This coincides with the third Buddhist Council. We see this big transmission. It also coincides with the reign of a very important Buddhist king in India, King Ashoka, who was responsible for spreading Buddhism not just in India, but east and west, quite far west as well, across the Persian Empire, what becomes the Persian Empire. So the map's not there, but you can see the transmission. This is need not be this line. This is not an accurate sort of depiction of where it went, but it's trying to stay on land rather than going through water, which is the Bay of Bengal here, if you saw the map. So it goes from Rajagriha, where it was first collected, right, at that first Buddhist council, these three baskets, down to the island of Sri Lanka in the south. And then in the first century of before the Common Era, the Tripitaka is put to writing. So this is considerably later. We see it first collected in the 5th century BCE, and it's not put to writing until the 1st century BCE. So there's a long period of oral transmission, and this is not uncommon in South Asia. It's a very common practice to have long periods of oral transmission.
Why would they call them baskets if it was an oral transmission?
I think insofar as...
You know, I always think of baskets as being baskets full of, you know, palm leaves or something with stuff inscribed on it.
That's in fact what it becomes, but the idea is that it's stuff that's collected together, and where do you collect things but in a basket in that way, with the basket being a collection of knowledge that we share.
So when it moved from an oral body of knowledge to written, was it still in Pali in Sri Lanka, or was it a different language entirely?
Well, here the thing about Pali as well as Sanskrit is you can write these languages, just like most languages, in any script, right? So you could write Pali in Sinhala or Sinhalese script, so long as you have the sounds there, that's still that language. Just like we can take Sanskrit, and I have done with a word like Tripitaka. This would not be how it looks in Sanskrit, but I'm writing it in our Roman script. And so you can find Pali and Sanskrit texts in multiple different scripts, in which South Asia, India, and then throughout South Asia has many, many different possible scripts, including the language in Sri Lanka, which is Sinhala. And I'm going to show you what that looks like, too.
Okay, so basically then, the Pali canon that is available to us is as accurate as it gets from the oral transmission to the written word. Is that right?
Yeah, and the idea of accuracy is the question of accuracy is an interesting one in South Asia. As I said, there are lots of traditions, not just in Buddhism in this case, but Hindu traditions where the knowledge that we have available to us today in a certain text wasn't put to writing for centuries before it was put to writing. But the languages of Sanskrit and Pali, these two classical Indian languages, the grammars are such that if you're actually reciting these things according to the way in which they were composed orally, there should be no room for error or mistake. And it's obvious if there's a mistake if you're knowledgeable of those languages. So they're able to preserve over time at an extraordinary level of perfection. And often in a lot of societies, the idea that you put something to writing lends a kind of legitimacy to it, lends a sort of air that it's going to perdure or persist over time, you know, in a way that an oral transmission or an oral sort of body of knowledge won't. That's not always the case, actually, in South Asia. In fact, you find a lot of errors in the transmission of manuscripts as they're composed in the written form, because people hire somebody to write a new text of the Pali Canon so you can keep it in your house or something, and then the scribes perhaps are not educated in the way that the people who are transmitting things orally, and they introduce errors, and maybe their text becomes the source of another transcription, and errors then proliferate in ways that it didn't in the oral tradition. So if that helps, or maybe that confounds what you're just asking, but the accuracy actually is there orally in a way that we don't always expect.
Okay, then there must be certain written records that are more reliable than others based on...
Yeah, of course, there are, but this is also something a lot of people will argue about in terms, and people's careers are based on arguing for certain sorts of origins, right? And the quest for origins is always problematic, whether it's simply just the original text of something or the origin of a word or the use of a concept or something. But but then ultimately scholars will come to some agreement as to what's likely to be the oldest, most accurate sort of original. So when it's put to writing, what happens? What we see is that it's done in a process on palm leaf manuscripts. And it is what it sounds like. These are palm trees. We're in Sri Lanka. It's a tropical climate. Lots of palm trees. So leaves from the palm trees would be pulled off, quite large, and dried out, and then cut into similar sizes, usually in a long rectangular shape. And somebody would then take this oral knowledge that we've just been talking about, including the Four Noble Truths that were contained in the Sutra Pitaka, and they would use what this guy has right here, which is a kind of stylus. This one's wood. I've seen them as metal as well. Very fine point. And this is the palm leaf right here. And carve into the palm leaf the teaching or the conduct or whatever, you know, is being transcribed in this case. And it's really carved in. There's no ink or anything on a stylus at this point. And then over the top of what has just been carved in the palm leaf on the stylus is a brush with a kind of black graphite sort of material that is brushed over the top of it, which sinks down into the text itself. And then you can read what was carved into much more clearly. The rest is brushed off. And then you don't have any sort of ink on the palm leaf, which helps preserve it for a little bit longer than if you were to be adding a new a wet substance to it. And so what I brought something for us, I brought show and tell today that I'd like to show you, is I have a Sinhalese manuscript, not of the Pali Canon, but unless you read Sinhalese, I probably shouldn't have said it, you wouldn't have known. And I'd like to open it up, if we could clear out a space, and then you could all actually have a look at it. But
I just want to move this out of the way.
Generally speaking, this is a very standard... This is a very nice representation, a very sort of pretty one, of what a manuscript in South Asia, whether you're in any one of these countries that are mentioned in South Asia, would look like. It would look like this. You've got a bunch of palm leaves in the middle, and then some sort of a cover on the outside. And this is just a very, as I said, a very decorated one here. They're not all like that. The ones I tend to work with usually have just a kind of plain, nothing on it, and not even nearly as thick, often broken. This is from Sri Lanka. It's about 100 years old. And I'm just going to move this down. I can put it over here next so that you guys can see it. I've never tried to open it standing up, so I don't know if I think I can. So this is essentially what you might say the beginnings of book culture, right, in this South Asian tradition. So you see that there's a string coming through, and there are two holes put through right there. That's the binding, essentially. And so when you read this, you would take the string and undo it, and you would lift up the binding, and you would lay this down like so. And then on here you have the first part that was carved out. Now this manuscript is interesting insofar it's been carved on both sides, which is pretty astonishing when you get a chance. And you should feel free to touch this. It's fragile. It's 100 years old, but it's not so fragile that you can't touch it. And this is what the first sort of editions of the Pali Canon, the Buddhist text, would have looked like. And that's actually Sinhalese, the language that you're seeing there. You can kind of feel how that was pushed in rather than written on top.
So what is the content?
This is a Hindu text about Nagas, these snake gods.
Yep.
To follow up on Chris's question, the Pali Canon, most scholars would feel, is probably the closest that we will know to the actual oral teachings of Buddha.
Yeah, and this is where, because the Theravada traditions, these early, what's often called mainstream Buddhism by scholars, these early 18 schools of Buddhism in South Asia, out of which only Theravada has survived, and they are considered the conservative sort of branch of Buddhism. And part of the reason for giving that label is that they try to adhere as closely to the Tripitaka or the Pali Canon as possible, as the foundation of practice.
I've noticed that this is a completely different tradition, but I've noticed that in some Tibetan Buddhist traditions, they use something similar to this to
yeah.
that purpose. purposefully, and also in Tibet, were they using similar material?
There's a very rich tradition of manuscript culture in Tibet. They also have woodblock prints in Tibetan culture. In the monastery in Ithaca, for example, the Tibetan monastery, they're just walls of manuscripts. And it's a very rich scholastic tradition, Tibetan Buddhism, that is very close to the Indian scholastic traditions, which rely upon the study of texts, really intense, many, many years of texts.
Yeah, I was just, because when you pulled that out, I just looked at the way it's structured. It looks so similar to...
The thing about a place like Tibet is or North India, or in the Himalayas, in Nepal, for example, manuscripts on palm leaves, right, in those locations are likely to have a much longer lifespan than in Sri Lanka or Kerala, where I work, which is in South India, where it's very hot and humid, and the infrastructure today for archives and libraries is not really up to the kind of climate and wear and tear that these things get. And so when I encounter manuscripts that are 100 years old, like this one, I'll open it up to wormholes and, you know, parts just falling out. And then, depending on what you sort of energy you have, your process of research can be trying to figure out what's in the gaps. And it's important. And some people do just that, try and recover what was in the manuscripts.
So what is the date of the very oldest Pali Canon manuscript?
The manuscript? I don't know what the actual oldest manuscript would be. Mm-hmm. I don't know where that is, actually. Uh-huh. That's a good mm-hmm. question. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm not sure. But we have, you know, copies, things that have been transmitted mm-hmm. that go back to right around the time, you know, they're pretty confident that it was not too far removed from when it was put to writing. Mm-hmm. But who owns the oldest manuscripts? A good question. I'm not entirely sure. Mm-hmm. Would you like me to put this for you guys to see?
Sure.
Yeah. Yeah, that's also unusual. You don't always find pictures. I like this one for that. Those are the snake gods. This is what this text is about. These half men or half human, half snake deities.
So the north.
It's fragile. So they're back to the word now.
Makes sense.
A longer life.
And then he's going to also be aware of the individual or the fly tall.
Yeah. And you can see, so this is the backside. Yeah. Which to me is really astonishing. A lot of it, but I wish they were just one-sided.
They're very frugal.
Maybe that's the reason. Yes.
Probably
that's I mean, that's a lot of
area.
You look at the front.
It's very long. It's such a long line to read. I remember reading
it's like animal books on lunch. I go to the right person after lunch.
Who's that?
That's Archie.
That's
John's dog.
Cool.
Scientist.
Yep. He's a golden doodle.
Just lost my dog.
There's a problem again.
Goofy dog. What a good goofy dog.
Being able to follow.
So, how much textual variation is like among the cancer I assume, but there may be different copies of it, deviants, but some, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, over time it starts to have a little bit of variation, and then your Mahayana is formed. You get introduced a whole bunch of new possible sutras that the Buddha said that wouldn't be in the original sort of Pali Canon. And so you have fragments.
None of the Zen sutras are old, probably. It's all, they're all, no doubt,
Theravada Buddhism,
from Western.
The canon would be very fixed as far as there being. There wouldn't be like different versions of it.
No, from Sri Lanka to Cambodia, you're going to see a very high level of consistency in that way. I'll say one more thing. I think there's one more slide, if you could bear with me. Just, I think the last thing I want to say is that it's not the only, Pali canon is not the only canon, right? So we have a Pali canon, and we refer to them in terms of the languages they're written in. Pali, Chinese, and Tibetan are the three primary Buddhist canons that we have here. So that's where I was going to stop.
So where are these different, these old canons, that, I mean, the Pali is the old one.
It's the one that, we were sort of just speaking about that, is that later on, over time, when there are reform movements within Buddhism, where Mahayana comes out, the greater vehicle introduces new sutras that the Buddha said.
Maybe.
Yeah, so this is, there's disagreement, right? And then the Abhidharma Pitaka, that third one, gets a lot of elaboration in some of these later schools, and they become very important for some schools in ways that it's not as important. It's still important, but not as important in others. But it's the basket where there's room to sort of move.
But these canons then include the Travadaka then. In other words, each of these canons contains all three baskets. And to one degree or another, they have evolved from the original Pali canon. Is that correct?
That's nice to put, yeah.
All right. Are each of these, though, transitions from oral to written tradition, for the Chinese and the Tibetan canons? Or what are they just compilations? Or?
No, these are primarily beginning with a sort of written tradition. The story of the Chinese canon in this case is, have you heard of the story, The Journey to the West? It's a story from China about a Buddhist monk who travels from China to the Himalayas to gather Buddhist manuscripts and bring them back to China, and he opens his translation school, essentially. It's very important for bringing actual texts.
Wasn't his name Tripitaka?
He's called Tripitaka in the story because he's so knowledgeable about the three baskets. Yeah. But then you see not just his three baskets are bigger than the three baskets. Zhuangzong is the Chinese name.
So one thing I'm just curious, if since the Mahayana introduced some new sutras, what was the process whereby some of the old Pali ones seem to have dropped away from the Mahayana?
The process, like,
I'm just wondering what happened there. I've at least the little bit I've read has mentioned that many of the Pali sutras became unknown to Mahayana by some point in history.
Just they are not taught in that, or not included in the canon.
Right,
you mean the process by which. I'm not sure exactly how to answer that. Their emphases are different, and so the parts of the original, or the original is not the best word to use, the parts of the Pali canon that are adopted and then reformed in a way become the foundation for those new traditions.
So some parts just weren't adopted.
In a way, and one of the main sort of early critiques of Mahayana traditions of the early 18 schools in South Asia, of which Theravada is the one that survives, is that there's not enough emphasis on things like compassion and loving kindness. In the reading of a biography of the Buddha, that stand out for the Mahayana reformers in those early days, and so there's a kind of, if there's a process in this way, it's a process of highlighting things that are introducing sayings that the Buddha said that emphasize those aspects of practice and so on, if that makes sense. Deborah?
It seems like this was a time when kind of the foundation of how Buddhism would evolve and be thought about was created with the... I think
some of the criticism that some of us have felt about, you know, Zen or Buddhism is that it does, it's not inclusive of family. It's more of a solitary kind of thing. And I was just wondering, was there any way in which that was thought about or talked about back then?
Family.
Yeah.
Family's an issue.
You leave your family.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that's a really great question. I hadn't really thought about it. But, you know, the story of the Buddha's awakening at 29 is leaving a wife and a small newly born child and his mother and father and, you know, his family. His wife and his son become disciples.
Yeah, they come back to him.
Well, they come back to him as disciples. Right. There's room for in the lay community for family in that in the way that there isn't in the monastic community in early Buddhism. But that's just something I need to think about. That's a nice, very nice question. One of the critiques, maybe if this fits off of what we were just talking about in the Mahayana reform movement, is that there's perhaps too much individualism in the early mainstream traditions of which Theravada is the one that we still see today. And therefore, that's why they're not emphasizing things like compassion and loving kindness that maybe we identify with something like the institution of the family. That's something that I'm going to have to think on. That's a great, great question.
It's the same thing, though, with Christ. He said, basically, leave your mother and your father and come with me.
It's a new family in that way, right? Yeah. The Sangha it's community. No, it's not called family. No. It's, so this is a good question.
Yeah, the Sangha was originally the community of monks.
Right.
Yeah. And then the lay community, I mean, the ideal there was to follow those first five precepts, to practice kindness and virtue, and then to be reborn in a subsequent life as a monk, or, you know, to become a monk or a nun. That was basically your path.
Yep.
Yeah, that was where you're headed. Although, I was just reading the Karen Armstrong book about the Buddha, and even in early Buddhism, there were cases of lay people who reached nirvana.
Sure.
Yeah. So it wasn't, like, impossible.
Yeah, and that's, you know, and this is something that Mahayana emphasizes, too, is that the critique of Theravada is that it's not open to anybody except a really elite group, whereas it should be open to everybody wherever you are. And
but
it becomes a point.
How do children become a part of a community? Do you know what I'm saying?
Of the Sangha?
Mm-hmm.
Well, his son. This is the story.
Yeah, he became a disciple. I mean, anybody who's had a couple of kids knows that most of them aren't going to be interested. Do you know what I mean?
Well, same with any religion,
you know,
I would say.
I mean,
you know?
Religions, at least how they play out, tend to be very family inclusive.
Yeah. Well, the family component's still there. I think if we look today in various Buddhist communities, there's definitely a family component. In some societies, it's still very, very much a positive thing within a family to send off your son or daughter into the monastic community. It's seen as a very worthy thing to do, but not everybody will do that, and they'll raise their kids like, you know, in a lay setting, and they'll grow up and have kids themselves and so on and still practice as Buddhists. But if we talk about what this means in the grand sort of cycle of one's life and as a Buddhist, different traditions will have things to say about whether you need to come back as a monk or a nun in order for that final awakening to happen. And in Theravada, the earliest paradigm, the model for a person is called an arhat. It changes us to a bodhisattva in the Mahayana traditions, and the bodhisattva represents, somebody mentioned something about this already in the course of our conversation, but represents those ideals of compassion and loving kindness in a way that the arhat doesn't, who takes that final nirvana when it's available, as opposed to the bodhisattva who sort of hangs around in a supra-mundane way and sort of leads people and ushers them on their path throughout lifetimes to awakening. The family question's a good question. It's probably a good question for every religious tradition as we think about, you know,
in crowds and out crowds, and what the sort of goals are, and you know who's eligible for them in ways that others maybe are not, so on. Nice question.
Another question about dates. So when was the Vimalakirti Sutra? It's not one of the Zen sutras. If that's one of the when was that? Or is that in a basket? Or
I don't know the date of that. Yeah, uh-huh. Sorry. Uh-huh. I could find out, and if you'd like, I could get to it for you. But off the top of my head, I don't have a date.
Uh-huh. That is a very popular sutra in Zen tradition. It's one of the two or three that are not the words of the Buddha, just like the Platform Sutra.
Yes.
Which, you know, comes from Huineng, about 500 or so.
Even some of the Sutra Pitaka, there are a couple things in there that are not just the Buddhas. There will be important things that the head disciples or leading disciples said as well, but it's primarily just what the Buddha said.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Would the extinct older traditions of the 18, would they have shared pretty much the same canon?
The Pali Canon?
Yeah.
This is where you start seeing a lot of the sort of yes and no, right? You see a lot of ideological disagreement, primarily at the level of interpretation of what the Sutra Pitaka meant in that way. There's less disagreement in terms about what was said as opposed to what it means. And in South Asian religious traditions, use the word religious in this way sort of loosely, but process of debate and argumentation was a way in which to win followers, mm-hmm. and to in the way in which traditions fade. And so there were 18 of these original schools. Over time, through these processes of losing members through argumentation or for whatever, you know, socio-historical reasons, Theravada is the one that had the sort of most conservative approach to, you know, how to practice what was said by the Buddha that was able to persist over time. But you'd find that at the level of interpretation of what was in the Sutra Pitaka is where the sort of splinters happened in that way.
They would have had different Abhidharmas over time?
Yeah, except the Abhidharma, even while those 18 schools were there, is still a pretty amorphous sort of thing. We call it this third basket because there was this collection of things that are interpretations, but it's really not until about 400 or 500 years later that we actually have an idea that what we read today as the Abhidharma Pitaka really starts to take shape. It's much later. At the time of the first council, what we talked about today, it was really just getting down what he said and what Gautama said and did before time passed. Yeah.
In that first map you had, you were talking about Southern Asia, and you said it's important to include Pakistan and Afghanistan. What's the legacy or the movement of the tradition, if at all, into those regions and more to the west? Did it really exist in Afghanistan? Did it exist well past?
Some of our earliest... it's a really good question. In fact, Afghanistan has some of the earliest art historical... Buddhist material comes from this region of Kandahar, what would be modern Kandahar around there. And the images of the Buddha from that region reflect the kind of couture and physiognomic preferences, if we could say that, of the region. So the Buddha has a mustache in a lot of the sculptures and things from this part of the region. There's a really interesting movie called The Giant Buddhas. Have you ever heard that? Yeah, these humongous statues of—is it two maybe Buddhas? It's been a while since I've seen
it.
Herat. What's that?
In Herat. Help me out.
These are the ones that Taliban blew up. Yeah.
Right, and they show the actual—you hear the dynamite, and then you see them crumbling. They're very old, so what you have is you have a great. Great transmission across the north. This way it goes out. Ashoka, King Ashoka, is one of the really sort of prominent, most important political figures to spread it out. And he was also situated in this area here. His home base was Pataliputra right here. And he spread Buddhism out this way, all the way up into the, past the Persian Empire, almost to the Mediterranean. He had envoys going out that way. And then down this way, of course, into Sri Lanka. It was his son and his daughter who established the first Sangha in Sri Lanka. And then, of course, into to Southeast Asia down this way too. But it goes out that way quite far. And then later, after the early centuries of the Common Era, you've got really high trafficking along what's called the Silk Road trading routes, which go all the way from Japan to Europe. And then you have plenty of interesting Buddhist texts which reflect this sort of coming together of cultural ideas, religious ideas from all over the world. And Buddhism is a really rich sort of part of that, too.
Is that like your third talk?
The third talk is about different cultures of Buddhism. So, how it looks, sort of about that. Yeah, different locations. Great questions. Thanks for the questions.
Thank you.
If you'd like one.
So the next one will be April 6th.